Hi, everybody. It's Stefan Molyneux from Free Domain Radio. I have David R. Barker, adjunct professor at the University of Iowa, on the line. You can catch his illuminating writings at barkerecon.com. He was an adjunct professor at the University of Chicago from 97 to 06. And truly crawling out from the belly of the beast, he was an economist at the Federal Reserve Bank of New York from 1991 to 1994. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, I wonder if you could tell the lovely listeners and watchers a little bit about your development into, would it be fair to say, an anarcho-capitalist? The terms are always sort of voluntarist. Anarchist, of course, is kind of loaded. But how would you describe your ideology?
Well, as far as terminology, I guess the best one I've heard is private property anarchist. But, I am sympathetic to those views.
Okay, that's a good answer. And what was it, mostly an intellectual development? Was it an emotional development? Was it both? What was it that drew you down this line? Obviously, you know, coming from the Chicago school, you've been exposed to a fair amount of Friedmanite kind of libertarian thought. But what was it that, in a sense, pushed you off the cliff where you think you're going to fall forever, but you land on the giant helium upward lifting balloon called anarcho-capitalism? What was it that drew you along this path?
I was actually exposed to these ideas a long time ago. I went to my undergraduate work was at University of California at Berkeley, where I learned sort of standard, I guess what you might call liberal economics. Then I spent a year at the London School of Economics, and I met a lot there. You know, my professors were mostly socialists and communists, which was fascinating. I mean, I loved learning the economics of planning. But I also met a lot of members of the Libertarian Alliance over there, and David McDonough, Jan Lester, David Ramsey Steele, people like that. And they laid out the case for anarcho-capitalism. They also gave me David Friedman's book, The Machinery of Freedom, and a lot of other books. And I was fascinated with the ideas, but not convinced. And who knows why, you know, perhaps, a lot of reasons. I think, you know, it takes time to get comfortable with these ideas. And also, of course, I was looking forward to a career. And, you know, these ideas are not exactly...
I'm an anarchist. Will you give me tenure? Right.
Exactly. So I went for graduate school to the University of Chicago. And as you say, you know, learned a lot of sort of more libertarian ideas, although not anarcho-capitalist exactly, but not hostile to that either. I think a funny story that someone I knew from the Libertarian Alliance came over and met a lot of the economists that I knew from the University of Chicago. And he was used to, saying things that were shocking to people and, was used to dealing with that reaction. When he talked to my friends at the University of Chicago, he'd say, you know, things like, well, you know, we should have a market for organs, or we should have, you know, markets, to help with adoption and things like that.
Why can't people sell their children? Right. Absolutely.
But you know, the Chicago economists would just nod and say, well, yes, that makes a lot of sense. And, so he was surprised to see that reaction. So, I mean, it's they're not so distant, I think, University of Chicago, the Chicago school economists and anarcho-capitalists. Well, so anyway, so I finished at the University of Chicago. I think as sort of a conventional libertarian, Republican leaning person
just the evils of rent control, the evils of the minimum wage, and the beauties of free trade, and all those kinds of things. Of course, the challenges of the welfare state. So really, trying to move the government back in time, but not to where it wasn't there at all. Right. Okay.
Right. So then I applied for jobs. The best offer I had was from the Federal Reserve Bank of New York. And so I took that job.
Good thing you completed your anarchist education at that point, or that would have been, all right, I can sell my soul. By the way, rent my soul for a certain amount of time to this arachno spider eating of fiat currency.
Right. Well, I loved my time at the Fed. I mean, the people there, a lot of brilliant people, a lot of very well-meaning people, and really a very, very interesting place to work. And I think more and more, I mean, just on a personal level, I learned that I'm not sort of the employee type. I'm not a government employee type. I don't think I would work well doing that for a long period of time. And I also saw more and more things that reminded me of my Chicago teaching that, you know, regulation is an inefficient way to do things. and just thinking about alternatives to say, well, you know, we're doing this, but markets could do it better. And what I think I finally concluded about the Federal Reserve in my own mind was that, you know, they're doing they're doing as good a job as they can, but it's really an impossible job. They're trying to be a central planner in money markets. And I think we've learned over the last few decades that markets do better than central planners. So given the limitations, given how difficult the job central planning is, I think the Federal Reserve does a remarkable job, but I think markets would do a better job. Anyway, so in the early 90s, I left the Fed because of some business opportunities here in Iowa. And so I've gotten into the real estate and finance business here. And, you know, time in business does tend to convince people even more that there are problems with government and that private markets can do things better. And so I think my years in business and then also reflecting on what I saw in government have convinced me of this. And I guess you're talking about what made me go over the cliff. I think it's really just the last few years since the financial crisis. I tended during the mid, you know, so 2005, 2006, I would listen to people like Ron Paul and say, well, you know, they're predicting doom and collapse. And I didn't believe that. I thought, you know, look, things are good. If we got rid of government, well, government is a drag on the economy. If we got rid of it, maybe things would be 20 or 30 or 40% better, but it's not such a big deal. Things are improving. The economy's growing. Maybe it would be better without government, but why make a big fuss about it?
Well, of course, which is what Ron Paul is wrestling with at the moment, I would think, is that the pain of getting rid of government and all of the people who've become dependent upon government and who really don't have any other alternatives. I'm thinking sort of old poor people on Social Security and, you know, people with eight kids on welfare and so on. The pain of getting rid of government will be considerable, and it's, of course, getting worse day by day. So I think I can see that from a pragmatic standpoint, that it's like, okay, well, it's a drag, but the pain of getting rid of it is even worse, so we'll just struggle along with it and hope to reform it.
No, I agree. I wrote a paper called The Rocky Road to Paradise, where I argued that it's conceivable that even if a completely free market system would be better, far better than what we have now, the pain of getting there, given assumptions about discount rates and things like that, might not be worth going down that path.
Sorry, you said
there.
Given the assumptions about discount rates? I wonder if you could just blow that out.
Right,
for, I'd like to say for the benefit of the audience, but I'll include myself in that number too.
Sure. No, so let's say that we could go down the path towards anarchy. And in the somewhat distant future, things will be far better. But in the, you know, in the medium term, things will be much worse. Well, if a person's discount rate, in other words, how much they value the future relative to the present, depending on what that is, and we read that preference in interest rates, for example, right? If there are very high interest rates, then people are rewarded greatly for postponing their consumption. If interest rates are very low, that means that people need less of a reward to postpone their consumption into the future. So their valuation of the future versus the present
is
different.
That's, sorry, just to clarify, so, that's assuming a free market in interest rates, which has not been seen in the Western world for, 70, 80 years?
Right. That's a good point, right. But in theory, interest rates would reflect our preference for the present versus the future. The other transition costs, for example, let's say that we have a system where we have deposit insurance for banks, and we also regulate what banks can do. Well, as we move down the road to privatization, someone might say, well, let's remove the restrictions on what banks are allowed to do. But we forget or we're unable to get rid of deposit insurance. Well, then the banks say to themselves,
that's
great.
Leverage, baby.
You know, heads that. Right. Exactly. You know, there are all kinds of examples of this, and economists talk about it as the rule of second best, that if we're not in an optimal world, then an incremental movement towards what we might think of as being optimal isn't necessarily going to produce good, is not necessarily going to make things better, because, you know, all these different parts are interacting with each other, and, you know, sometimes if we make a partial move towards privatization, we can actually make things worse.
Right.
So all of these things I was, you know, thinking about and thinking, well, you know, so it's probably not worth the bother of getting rid of government. But you know, the financial crisis and the run-up in debt and the realization, when you just look at the numbers, that there's no way for the government to get, for the United States federal government, to get out of the hole that it's in without dramatically raising taxes or cutting spending, which seems politically impossible, or inflating or triggering a financial crisis by defaulting on debt, just made me think, wow, you know, also looking at what's going on in Europe, right? Things that no one would have, you know, if you had predicted in 2005, the kinds of turmoil that's going on in Europe now, people would have thought, you know, you're crazy. If you'd predicted the housing crisis in 2004, 2005, people would have thought, you know, you were crazy.
Well, even though the mathematics are very clear. I mean, the mathematics of European debt and the fact that they can't devalue their currency anymore, or these individual basket case economies can't. I mean, the math is pretty clear. So it's almost like, well, you know the numbers are going that way, but you sort of never expect that it's quite going to land. But so it always does, right? So,
yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, that's everything is clear in hindsight. But in 2005, it was difficult, I think, for most people to see that we were in trouble. And I agree, there are a few people who were out there saying that was going to happen. I was not one of them. But all of these things happening have caused me, I think, to rethink a bit and say, you know, maybe it's a little more imperative that we either, you know, shrink government or ultimately get rid of it given the circumstances.
Now, economists are notoriously pragmatic. And of course, many of the arguments for a free market are arguments from efficiency. And I mean, there are some areas of fairness. And I think that a lot of economists from the free market school are very sensitive to the degree of destruction wrought upon the lower classes by things like rent control and especially the minimum wage. But of course, there is the other argument for anarchy, which is to say that if you're going to respect the non-aggression principle and property rights, if you sort of make the moral case from the beginning, then it's a series of dominoes that sort of knocks over government and other institutions almost accidentally if you just hold to those first premises. Would you say that it's largely a pragmatic approach for you, or is there that moral essence in it as well? And I know for an economist, that's a dangerous term to use, but
I think it's still, for me, it's mostly pragmatic. In my book, I sort of lay out a scenario where the government collapses and free markets take its place. And I do think that free markets are the most natural way for people to interact. And I think that government may be something that will become obsolete over time. You know, government may have made sense for various reasons over some periods in history. But I think, you know, particularly, and technology may drive this to some degree. And I think most of of what's going on in technology favors markets over governments. So I see this as a possible future that may happen, may not. And I wrote the book just to explain why I thought that it's possible that a society like this could work.
So this is the book, sorry to make sure the readers get a chance to see this. This is Welcome to Free America, which, by the way, is available for $3 on the Kindle version. So you absolutely owe it yourself to go and get a copy, wherein your description seems to be that we become free because we become completely exhausted by endless government failures and catastrophes. Almost like it's like the drunk who doesn't become a sober because he sees the light, but rather he's just tired of waking up in a ditch in Vegas with panties from hookers on his head. Does that, I may be layering a metaphor in that you haven't thought of, but.
That's about right. That's about right with one difference. And that's that I think a free market system will not be able to survive unless we have the right culture for it. And I think just as democracy would have seemed unlikely several hundred years ago, people would say, well, you can't have democracy because, you know, whoever loses the election will just shoot the winner and, you know, you'll always decide things by force. Well, we developed a culture that respects the idea of democracy and respects the outcomes of elections. And it's remarkable that people, you know, when people get fewer votes, they step aside, let the other guy come in. And it works reasonably well, and much far better than anyone would have guessed, I think, a few hundred years ago. And I think the same thing is true for markets. If we have a culture that respects and understands markets, then I think a completely free market system could work. But without that culture, I think if the government collapsed, we would simply move to a dictatorship or a new form of government.
Yeah, no, I certainly would agree with that. And this really comes back down to the argument of why do you get rid of an institution like slavery? I mean, I'm sure economists, and obviously I can't speak for all, I'm sure economists would say something like, because slavery is economically inefficient relative to the capital injection you'll get with private property and labor costs and mechanization. And of course, other people would say, well, it's evil to own other human beings and so on. So I think until people understand the pragmatic arguments, I would also argue that until people really get the moral nature of government, which is, of course, that government is the agency that has a monopoly on the initiation of force, and we all recognize in our personal lives, force is not a good way to get what you want. If we can extend that socially, I think then we'll be ready for that kind of culture, but I think it's a multi-generational process.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, I think slavery, though, is an interesting issue. And one that I talk about some in my book, because think about this situation. Suppose that you've got a kid who wants to finance his college education, and he says, okay, I'll sell to investors a 1% share in my future income in return for some money that I can use for my education. Well, that seems perfectly reasonable. It seems like something that in a free market society might develop. And someone might also develop central markets where people could buy and sell shares. And
sorry, if I can understand this correctly, this is just another way of saying I'm going to take out a loan.
Yes, but a loan is different. Debt is different than equity, right? So student loans, you pay back a fixed amount of money and you're done. If you sell equity in yourself, then whatever your future income is, the investors will take, say, 1% of that.
Right, right.
And that might be a more efficient way for people to finance, say, a college education, than straight debt.
And it certainly keep people out of the arena of wasting time and resources, you know, with sort of a history of Byzantine art and the 8th century courses, which are fun, but see, always struck me more like hobbies than careers.
Right, right, right. And investors might say, well, no, if we're going to invest in you, you're going to study this instead. You're going to do something that is going to pay off. And then, you know, if someone can sell 1%, why not 10% or 30% or 51%? And in those cases, investors might take a real, very strong interest in where a person lives, what kind of job they take, and what they do. And the person might, in some sense, be an indentured servant. Other people might pledge themselves as collateral for a loan, right? If I don't own anything, but I want to start a business, I might say to a potential investor, lend me some money. And if I don't pay you back, I'm yours, or some fraction of my future income is yours. And we might have people voluntarily ending up in something that resembles slavery. And I think it's an interesting question whether that's compatible with our idea of liberty.
Arguments pop into my mind against that, which I will let you casually bat down like a cat playing with a ball of yarn. The first, of course, is that as an investor, I would want to not own 80% of someone, because their incentive to work hard when they're only receiving 20% of what they make would, I mean, that's the same with high taxation, right? It's why the Beatles and U2, despite their socialist ways, moved out of the UK to other sort of more. So I wouldn't want a very high percentage of somebody, because they would just not work very hard and I'd be less likely to get my money back. And of course, other investors, if I say 80, someone else is going to come in at 79 and 78. They're going to bid it down to the point where it is economically as productive as possible. I don't think it would ever get to 100%, because 100%, why would somebody can get out
well,
of it?
You could say the same thing about right? You could say the same thing about corporations today. You could say, well, employees of corporations ought to own stock in the companies that they work for. Otherwise, they'll have no incentive. Why would they care about the fortunes of the company if they don't own stock in it? But we seem to have naturally developed a division where investors own usually 100% of a corporation, and the employees work for a fixed salary, and somehow we manage to motivate them anyway. I think you're right that for most people, they wouldn't sell a large fraction of their future income, if any. But I think there would be exceptions to that. There's some people who would find that that was a better That was a better financing arrangement for them. And we would have some fraction of the population, it might be very small, but I think it would exist, of people who either sold some portion of their own income or pledged themselves as collateral and ended up not owning all of their future.
That's possible as well. Of course, the other argument would be that if somebody, say, wanted to get licensed as an engineer, of course, as you know, currently with the state, it's, you know, multi-year and, you know, tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. In a free market system, it would be far less, and there would be ways of studying. You know, you would either apprentice or something like that, be a way of getting the education that you needed without necessarily having to suspend all of your income for 5 to 10 years, say, to become an expert doctor. There would be ways of, as there used to be, of course, of apprenticing, so there would be ways for people to get that while actually having an income and be much less likely to, take my kidney if I don't pay you back kind of thing.
Yeah, no, I agree that there would probably be far much lower cost options for education and for career development than we
but
have
no,
now.
No, it's an interesting question, of course. Can you sell yourself? I think, again, the free market would likely not have much utility for that kind of interaction, but it certainly is a good question to ask.
You know, or even criminals, right? Someone, you know, the penalty, you know, some protection firms might call for penalties that would allow people to be incarcerated. Those people might essentially be slaves also. And I do think that slavery is more economically efficient than people often think. The work of Robert Fogel at the University of Chicago shows that slavery was a thriving institution before the Civil War, very, very profitable. And was ended by the Civil War, but slave prices were increasing up to the Civil War, not declining.
I would argue that that was largely because the slave owners were able to externalize the cost of enforcement to the state. I mean, you didn't have to send your own guys to go catch your slaves. You could socialize that cost.
They were taxed, though, to support that
everyone
activity.
Everyone was, not just the slave,
there were direct taxes on slave owners, though, that supported some of that activity. And even if you take that out, people differ on this, and this is not an area that that I'm a specialist in. But I think it seems possible, given the historical evidence, that it was an economically efficient institution. At least this is Fogel's argument, and he concludes his economic history course on the economic history of slavery by saying that it was economically efficient. And this is a real challenge to free market economics, that the Civil War, in his view, seems to have been necessary to end slavery.
I think just about every other country except for the United States, slavery was ended peacefully. And in Brazil, I've read, there's some dispute about this, but in Brazil, the government simply stopped catching the slaves and the whole industry collapsed.
Well, there are a lot of complications as to how this happened, there was also just overwhelming public opinion, worldwide public opinion against slavery and a feeling that this was an institution that needed to be eliminated, and there was government pressure to do so. I agree with you that I don't think slavery would be the basis of an economy. I think, though, that there would be a place for it, for something resembling it, and that it would be something that would exist in at a small level, but would exist. If I sort of pencil out the costs and the benefits, using numbers from prison industries today, I think it's something that could be profitable. And it's hard for me to see how a completely free market society would eliminate it. It's possible that boycotts and simple refusal to do business with anyone that had anything to do with it, it's possible that that would eliminate slavery. I just think we can't be sure.
Yeah, so the argument would be that you would not do business with any company that would respect a, quote, slave agreement. And, of course, charity would take the place. I mean, people would rather receive charity than sell off their future income. So if there was general social horror at the idea and a significant amount of charity, which I think we'd assume there would be in a free society, then it seems unlikely it would ever flourish. But I can certainly see the economic arguments for it.
Yeah, I think it's I think it is kind of a, uh, uh, I don't know, not necessarily a central argument, but I think it's an interesting thing to consider whether it would flourish or not in a free market.
Well, and certainly, even if we accept there'd be some portion of it, it would very likely be quite small. And secondly, of course, it would be far less than the slavery that occurs now. When you have countries going over 100% of GDP in debt, you could say pretty much everyone in the future is 100% owned and sold. So I think we can definitely say there'd still be a vast improvement.
Well, I don't know if I would go so far as to say that we are slaves because of debt. That's an interesting point. But again, you know, maybe that's not so, you know, maybe it's not such a bad thing. Maybe self-ownership implies the right to sell oneself. You know, in real estate, if we own a piece of real estate, a fundamental aspect of ownership is the right to sell that real estate. If you are prohibited from selling it, you don't really own it. If we own ourselves, why can't we take the risk of, say, pledging ourselves as collateral? Or selling some portion of our future income to someone else in return for money today. Maybe that's an important part of freedom.
Yeah, I certainly would have no principled arguments with that. I'd like to jump to something that you've written about quite extensively, which is private money. You know, when you start talking about no government, I mean, of course, a number of things that jump into people's heads, the roads and charity and healthcare for the poor and the sick and the aged and so on. But of course, another thing that people have a tough time imagining being private is money. You talk about privatizing money, it's like going to a bunch of skydivers midway through their drop and saying, we're repealing gravity. So you talked about a quote that struck me in one of your articles, which was, you wrote, private fiat money could solve the biggest problem in banking, which is bank runs. Banks borrow short and lend long. I wonder if you could explain a little bit about how private currency could deal with the problems of bank runs. And of course, for the listeners who are under 40, what bank runs are.
Right. So banks, what I mean by that they borrow short is that they're taking your deposits, right? So you put a deposit in a bank and you can withdraw it any time that you want. So it's short term. In other words, you know, there's no commitment that money stays there for any length of time. You can withdraw it, you know, after an hour if you want to. But the banks are lending long term. So they might make a mortgage on a piece of real estate and they don't expect to get that money back for years and years. Well, what if there's a news story that says that this bank has been badly managed and might go bankrupt? Well, all the depositors are going to say, well, I'm going to pull my money out. That's logical. It's rational for them to do that. So if the problem is that the bank doesn't keep enough cash, of course, right, to pay off all the depositors. And so everyone wants to be first in line to get their money before the bank runs out of money. Well, that's a particular problem of a bank that is lending in a currency that it doesn't control. One way that you could eliminate that problem would be if you had banks that, well, there are a number of ways to eliminate that problem. The way that government has chosen to do so is with deposit insurance. So the government says, look, if the bank runs out of money, we will pay you. And the bank pays a premium to the government, to the FDIC in the United States, for that insurance. The problem with that solution, of course, is that then the bank, as we were discussing before, the bank has incentives to take on extra risk because no matter what, their depositors won't discipline them by pulling their money out.
So that's a crazy system at the moment, and it's relatively recent. People don't know how recent it is, where, you know, if you pull money out of a profitable corporation into your sort of personal sphere, then if you've done horrible things to that corporation and ensured its future demise, the money can never be pulled back. I mean, it's like this one-way vacuum of money that has created this massive incentive for short-term gains at the expense of long-term stability. Sorry, I came out of the entrepreneurial world, so that's a quite passionate part of my entrepreneurial history. So,
yeah, no, and you could certainly imagine more. I think what people call clawback contracts that would discipline people for those sorts of things after the fact. But a way that free markets might address this problem would be, well, you could have different kinds of banks. I mean, you could deposit your money in banks that you knew were not taking big risks, right? Banks that put all the money into short-term assets so that they could easily liquidate and pay you back, something people often call narrow banks. Well, now there's no incentive to create a narrow bank because, you know, you get subsidized for creating a high-risk bank by the government. So that would be one way that free markets could handle this. But another would be, you know, private currency. So if a bank issued its own currency, and this might start with, you know, issuing, receipts for gold that was deposited, you know, and that these notes that give you the right to take some gold out of the vault might circulate as money. But eventually, after people get to trust a company and get used to using its currency, they might accept the currency even if there was nothing backing it up. So you might accept fiat currency from a private institution. So if a bank and this currency, there might be all kinds of innovations in currency that, you know, government has a monopoly on currency, so it isn't interested in innovation. It's got a guaranteed group of customers, no matter what it does. But if private companies were competing, then they would, you know, issue currency that, you know, maybe would have chips embedded in the currency that could do things. They could have lotteries that were based on the serial number of the currency that would, you know, make people want to hold their currency. The currency might pay interest. All kinds of things that would be better than the money services that we get today.
Again, but I think one thing that would be just fantastic for businesses, one of the huge drags on economic productivity is people don't know what the future value of currency. People don't know how much inflation there's going to be. It's almost inflation. And the fact that people don't know what future prices are going to be, the future value of currency is unknown, makes economic calculations in the free market or what's left of it very, very hard. And so one thing I would want from a private currency is for them to work as hard as possible to keep a constant dollar value, so I wouldn't have to all do those calculations in my head all the time.
Yeah, I think that's right. And companies would compete with each other to find out exactly what qualities people wanted. And stability would be one quality that people would want, among others. And companies would balance those and find the right mix. But if a company was able to issue fiat currency, in other words, currency with nothing backing it up in the vault except people's trust in that company, then if there was a run, then everyone would know that the company could simply print currency and pay everyone off. So there's no incentive to be first in line. And since everyone knows this, then the value of the company's currency would simply drop in the exchange markets. And again, there's no incentive to be first in line. Once the information reaches the marketplace, the value drops, and everyone knows that. And so you're happy to hold the note at its current market value, or you can trade it with someone because there would be markets at a certain price. And so the institution wouldn't collapse. You wouldn't have this this kind of artificial event of a bank run happening that causes bankruptcy and a lot of inefficiency, of loss.
Let me just make sure I follow that. So if the bank is unable to cover its obligations, it will print its money. But wouldn't that give everybody a very strong incentive to just spend it as quickly as possible and thus driving that money down in value very quickly? And wouldn't that...
Just because the value has gone down today doesn't mean it's going to continue to go down. Right. I mean, so the currency might take us, a one-time hit because let's say there's a news story that says, well, this bank made a bad investment and it's lost a certain amount of money. Well, maybe my money will drop in half, but I don't have any reason to think that it's going to. There's no reason. Once in a free marketplace, once the price hits a certain level, that's the market's best guess of the value of that currency. There's no reason to expect it's more likely to go up than down. Some people will want to get rid of it because there's a perceived increased risk. Other people will take advantage of that and buy it.
They'll want to buy it.
Right. So just like when a stock, when there's bad news about a company, its value might drop in half. But at that price, there are people willing to hold the stock. Right, that's what the market does. It balances supply and demand. It finds the price that allows that will convince enough people to hold it.
I'm trying to analogize this at the national level, so I can sort of put it into what I know a little bit about. So, I mean, obviously, prior to the euro, countries like Greece and Spain and Portugal would have devalued their currency in order to maintain some sort of competitiveness and to, I guess, in a sense, do a soft default through inflation. Is that sort of so they would just devalue their currency and that's how they would survive? And that's, of course, not available to these countries now.
And some companies would do that. But But companies would have a very strong incentive to convince their investors that that was not going to happen in the future.
Right.
Right. You would be as open and transparent as you could possibly be and say, look, you know, these are the things that we're investing in. They're very safe for these reasons. Our employees are all, you know, certified at what they do. And so a major devaluation is extremely unlikely, and that will convince people to hold their notes. Of course, some firms might take a riskier approach. They might say, look, yes, we're taking some risk and there's a chance of a devaluation, but you know, look at what a bargain our currency is. And so different people would choose different mixes of risk and return.
Right. One thing that I would want in a bank is that if there was any kind of bank run or if there was any kind of problems paying off obligations, the first place that would be targeted would be the personal assets of the executives, followed by the assets of the investors. And that would give me some comfort level that the management would have a strong incentive to minimize risk because they would be first in line to pay off creditors, which of course doesn't really happen at the moment, which is one of the reasons why corporations are a little bit monstrous in the modern world.
Well, that might happen. There would be a trade-off between the desire of investors like you for that sort of thing and the desire of companies to attract talented people. And talented people might say to the bank, well, yes, I'll come and work for you, but I'm setting aside this portion of my assets and you know, you're not going to be able to touch those because if something goes wrong, I want to have something to fall back on. And in you know, so the bank will have to make a trade-off and say, okay, how much do our investors demand this kind of accountability versus our need for talented people?
Yeah, and I think that would be, if you want less return, then obviously you would be more comfortable with lower risk, which would be attract more people who'd be willing to put up personal assets as collateral. And if you wanted higher returns, then yeah, I think you'd have to shield people from some of that risk.
Right, right. And I think, you know, markets are very good at finding that the right balance between risk and return for people with different preferences for risk.
Now, there's another topic which you've written about, which I find fascinating, which is you wrote that a German politician recently advised the bankrupt Greeks to sell the islands and the Acropolis and so on. And this was considered to be, you know, shocking, horrifying, and horrible. Of course, it was not considered to be so when the government nationalized all of this stuff. But tell me the degree to which you think national debts might cause a dumping of government assets, in a sense, a kind of privatization through a dumping of government assets into more free market institutions?
Well, the reason that I was interviewed on this topic is that I wrote a paper a few years ago about the purchase of Alaska by the United States in 1867, and I tried to look at that as a real estate investment for the United States, and I said, well, you know, let's look at all the costs to the federal government of running Alaska and all the benefits in terms of revenue that it collected in taxation from Alaska, and my conclusion was that it was a negative net present value investment, that simply, you know, paying off debt with the money would have earned a far greater return for the federal government than purchasing Alaska. And so this got a little bit of attention. I got some little bit of media attention for this. And so some reporters who were looking at, you know, possibly selling off Greek islands and things like that, they found this paper and said, oh, well, this is someone who, you know, has worked on valuing, you know, large chunks of territory that governments have. So that's just a little bit of background on it. I think in the current situation, governments are extremely reluctant to dump any territory at all. It's odd in a sense, but I think it's even given this, even with the severity of the financial situation now, I think it would have to get much, much worse before governments were willing to sell any territory. It used to be more common. The United States, like I said, you know, bought Alaska because the Russian Empire was short of cash.
The Louisiana Purchase,
the United States bought
the
Louisiana Purchase, right? Bought the Virgin Islands from Denmark, bought some territory from Mexico. Some involuntary transactions, some not so voluntary, but it's become far less common. And countries are willing to spend enormous resources to hold on to tiny chunks of rock out in the middle of the ocean, the Falkland Islands, not quite so tiny, but still inconsequential economically, culturally, politically.
Oh, it's the last bit of empire. You gotta.
But one reason for that, I think, is the, you know, that with those islands comes a claim that nations have negotiated with each other to the resources of the ocean for, you know, hundreds of miles, or I forget, was it 200 miles or something like that around those islands. And given that there might be oil in a lot of these places or minerals, countries, they appreciate the option value of holding on to territory. They say, look, might be worthless now, might be costing us money now, but who knows, in the next 100 years, this land might turn out to be enormously valuable.
And that paranoia, and so they, as a seller, that if somebody's willing to offer you a good price for something, they probably know something that you don't. And, oh, yeah, I'm not going to sell it now then, if somebody wants it.
Right. You know, plus the prestige value. I mean, it's nations are all sort of jockeying with each other for power and prestige, and giving up territory, I think, is seen as a real sort of loss of face, loss of prestige.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. I mean, it does indicate that nobody should buy your bonds because you're in a pretty bad.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
Where do you see? Right. That's the last question. I've sort of have a couple of others. I want to be sensitive to your time, though. Where do you see Europe going over the next year? I know that putting on the prognostication hat is always a risky business, so with all the caveats in the world, I can't see the euro lasting another year, but I mean, that might be just some pessimism. But where do you, Europe's an extraordinarily bad situation all round, and they don't have a lot of luxury to cut. America can cut the military-industrial complex and save some good coin that way without necessarily having the same kind of social disruptions as dismantling the European safety nets, as they're called. What do you see as the options? Are Germans going to want to continue working in their cold, snowy factories to make sure that 50-year-old Greek bureaucrats can sip daiquiris by the Acropolis? What do you think is going to happen to Europe over the next year?
Well, I think one thing is, I think you need to separate the issues of the euro and issues of debt. A European country, there's no reason why a European country can't default on its debt and stay in the euro system. Just as in the United States, if let's say that Alabama, for some reason, ran up too much debt and had to default, we wouldn't expect that to result in Alabama leaving the dollar. Europeans have tried to create this idea in people's minds that that we can't have defaults because there would be catastrophe because the euro would fall apart. But I think this is more to convince investors that a default's not going to happen. I think what will happen in the end is that my guess, and I don't have a lot of confidence in this prediction, this is simply my best guess as to how things will go. I think that they will preserve the euro, and they will, and the countries that are on the euro will stay on the euro, but I think there will be some defaults. Countries like Greece, maybe Italy, maybe Spain will default on their debt in some way, that they will package it all together, call it a restructuring of their debt instead of a default, but investors will end up losing money. Conversations that I've had with people at the European Central Bank have convinced me that a breakup of the euro to them is unthinkable. They say legally that it can't be done, that if a country were to move out of the euro, that the challenges in the European courts would be very powerful. Because, people would be losing a lot of money. People who had debts denominated in euros would suddenly be told, well, you're getting drachmas instead, which are worth far less, and they would sue in the European courts. So my guess is that your bondholders in some of these countries will take big losses, and that will eventually put these countries sort of back on a path that's sustainable in the medium.
Well, and of course, the credit rating of these countries that defaulted would just go through the floor.
That's true, but countries have defaulted in the past, and then, well, think about anyone who's declared bankruptcy. Within a few years, they're getting solicitations from credit card companies again, and the same thing is true for countries. Countries have defaulted a lot, including the United States, right? When we talk about Alexander Hamilton's, remarkable way that he was able to restructure American debt back in the late 1700s, well, really what it was a structured default, right? The bondholders got back less than they had originally been promised and originally invested. In the, I think it was the 1840s, several states in the United States took on too much debt and they defaulted. And, you know, it caused a lot of problems for investors. But very quickly, once they'd gotten rid of all of that debt, they were able to borrow again from either the same investors or from new investors, convincing them that now it's going to be different. We're going to manage our affairs differently.
Sorry, yeah, but Franklin Roosevelt. America at that time was a very young country with lots of skilled immigration, whereas Europe, of course, is a very aging population with a tiny, tiny non-replenishable birth rate and significant cultural problems with immigration. So again, I'm not saying it's not possible, but it's not quite the situation in terms of future growth potential.
That's true. That's true. Now, another default in the United States in American history is in the 1930s, right, when a lot of government debt had promises to pay in gold or the equivalent, and Franklin Roosevelt simply defaulted on that clause. He said, sorry, we promised this in our bonds, but we're not going to pay it. Well, most economists who look at that conclude that it was the best strategic thing for the American government to do. It did help from the government's point of view. That was the right thing to do. They were able to borrow again quickly. It didn't destroy their ability to borrow. I agree. Europe has serious structural problems, and that will limit the amount that investors are willing to put in. But Europe still does have enormous wealth and enormous resources, and investors will be willing to put some money into
that. Well, and of course, it's a massive step forward in European civilization that for the first time in history, these conflicts are being expressed in a financial rather than martial terms. I mean, all they're doing is bickering about debt and credit default swaps. They're not actually launching tanks across each other's borders. What a massive improvement in European civilization. I think that's wonderful.
That's true. I wonder if that's because they don't have the tanks that they used to have, because the United States has taken over their defense. They
just whatever don't it is, given what of, they did know. With the last century, the fact that they're just nagging each other about finances, I just think is completely wonderful. They're not turning the whole continent into a crater because they have disagreements.
Well, that's true, and it's a very good point. And that was really the point. That was really the purpose of the euro and of the European Union, was to prevent that from happening. I mean, there were economists who argued that the euro was, when it was started, that it was really a bad idea economically. But the goal was really political. It was really to bind Europe together and prevent them from having another war.
Countries that are countries in dire financial straits are always tempted by war. That's a very strong pattern in human history. So yeah, I agree with you. I think it's a big step forward. However collectivist it may seem, it's better than the individual solutions of the past.
Yeah. But like you say, I mean, it's true that Europe is a much more regulated society than ours, and as a result, I think it's much poorer than ours. If you look at per capita incomes and adjust for purchasing power parity and so on, you see that standards of living in Europe are significantly lower than they are in North America.
Well, listen, I really do want to appreciate your time. I just really want to make sure people get to your website. It's bakarecon.com, which has a list of your books and your speaking engagements, which are highly recommended. Really, really interesting stuff. You have a great patient and calm presentation style, which I must say that I somewhat envy. I tend to be a little hyper and hysterical, so good for you. That's very nice. And your new book, of course, Welcome to Free America. Highly recommended. I'll put the link to it below the video. And thank you so much, Dr. Bakar, for your time. It was really enjoyable.
Well, thank you. I enjoyed it too.